the homework gap, this digital divide, is creating a massive education divide that's getting wider every single day that students go without the connection and without being able to connect to schools.
Hi, I'm Ed Meyer, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations between policy experts, elected officials, and local business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable health care.
In this episode, we hosted a briefing between business leaders and John Bailey, visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Bailey outlined the causes of the homework gap, its impact on students during COVID-19, policy negotiations in Congress on this issue, and steps local business leaders can take to help. We hope you enjoy the conversation. John, thank you for joining us today. And could you kick us off by explaining the homework gap? What is the homework gap and how does it affect students, especially during this COVID-19 pandemic?
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you to Business Forward for hosting this briefing. Such a critical issue. I mean, just to give you a little background on the homework gap, it was the term of art that was given to the number of students who lacked devices or connectivity at home and were unable to complete a lot of homework assignments that were getting delivered or assigned to them through online platforms and online tools. And so there was this gap that there were some students who could participate in these extended learning opportunities in the evening. There were some students that couldn't. And because that was like homework, it was called the homework gap. The issue that has created this massive challenge for us is that as a result of COVID, almost every single school in the United States closed for most of the spring, and it forced schools to very quickly stand up remote learning plans that leveraged online learning. And what they found is that there were some students who just could not participate because they didn't have, again, the devices, the connectivity at home. And so this became not just a homework gap, but it became a schooling gap, a learning gap, that if you didn't have the devices and the connectivity, you literally were shut out of school for the better part of the spring and the summer. Now, how many students are we talking about? And here it's been a little bit challenging because we don't have very firm numbers. But there's been a recent estimate done by our good friends over at Common Sense Media and the Boston Consulting Group that using census data and some other statistical models, they estimate that it's about 9 million students who lack both adequate internet connections as well as a device. And a device is, in most cases here, we're talking about a tablet or a computer. And it's because, like, if you're trying to type out an essay, you really can't do that on your cell phone. You really need a laptop or a tablet that you can write out the essay, write out a paper, and do more of the interactive type of learning that schools are hopefully delivering. We also know from some recent COVID surveying that according to the American Association of Superintendents, that 81% of superintendents reported a lack of internet and devices was a major barrier to shifting to online learning this spring. We're also seeing some state-by-state reporting. So in Colorado, they surveyed every single school district, and they found that there were 65,000 students that lacked access to the internet from home, 55,000 lacked a device. And then not surprisingly, and perhaps most urgently, we're seeing huge equity gaps with the homework gap. Education Trust did a survey in California and found 38% of low-income families and 29% of California families of color lack the devices to connect to online resources as their schools went over. This has huge implications because, again, when we were just talking about homework, that meant just like missing a homework assignment and maybe missing a lecture in the evening. But literally not having a device of connectivity right now means students don't have access to their teachers. They don't have access to lessons. They don't have access to the video libraries that schools are putting up with different types of content. And what we know is that this has a huge effect on children. McKinsey estimates that the instructional disruptions caused by COVID in the shift to remote learning is going to lead to, on average, 7 months of lost learning. But it's going to be even worse with Black students losing about 10 months of learning and low-income students losing as much of a year. And that's just because, again, they've been out of school. They haven't had the interaction with their teachers. They haven't had all the instructional supports that they need, not just to keep current with their classmates, but also to catch up over the period of the summer here. We're seeing this, too, in other sources of data. So Raj Chetty and his team at Opportunity Insights, they analyzed 800,000 students who were using an online math program called Zurn. And what they found is, again, huge equity gaps, that by late April, student participation had fallen by 48% from low-income zip codes and by 25% from students from middle-income zip codes, while participation actually increased by 10% amongst those from high-income zip codes. And so, again, the homework gap, this digital divide, is creating a massive education divide that's getting wider every single day that students go without the connection and without being able to connect to schools. Now, during the summer, we had all thought that schools would be reopening this fall. We thought they would be reopening mostly in kind of a hybrid way, where students are in school part of the time and at home learning remotely the other part. But what it increasingly looks like is that a lot of schools are going to default to remote learning only as part of the start of the school years, or frankly, for most of the fall. As of yesterday, 10 of the 15 largest school districts are doing remote only. That's almost 2 million students. Governor of California has said that about 80% of their counties have to reopen remote learning only. And so this thing that we had thought was just a temporary way of learning in the spring looks like it might become more permanent for the fall, potentially going in through the next academic year too. So the challenge here is that we need to very quickly be able to get those low-income parents and their families with the device and the connectivity in order to allow them to continue participating in whatever type of learning options are available through their schools. The good news is that there seems to be growing policy support to address this. Senator Markey and other Senate Democrats have a $4 billion proposal that would allocate that funds through an FCC program called the E-Rate, and it would give the FCC the authority and that $4 billion to help close that homework gap, that connectivity between homes and their schools. We also have heard that Chairman Pai has requested dollars from Congress and in order to help address this program. The issue that seems to be the sticking point in Congress right now is around two different types of questions. One is about the size of the appropriation. The House Democrats had only appropriated $1.5 billion, and you have the Senate Democrats asking for $4 billion. So there's a difference in terms of the size. And then there's another difference, too, as to whether or not the program should go through the E-rate at the FCC or whether it should be through a new program. What we're finding is that a lot of the Senate Republicans and Chairman Pai would prefer a new program. Their belief is that it could be allocated faster. And you have a lot of the Senate Democrats who would prefer going through E-rate, hoping that it can get the dollars out in a faster way with all the quality control checks put in place. The challenge is that we have a very small window in order to get this into the next economic relief package. As you know, the Senate just dropped the Republican proposals yesterday, and the homework gap funding wasn't in the Senate proposals. What we're told in the hearing is that it's not that they oppose it, it's that they're waiting to bring that as part of the negotiations with the Democrats and with the House. But we can't take that for granted. We have to make sure that business leaders and school leaders are helping to make the case that looking at all the uncertainty that we're facing with education over this next couple of months, a quality connection and a quality device are going to be essential to making sure kids keep learning. The good news is that we see lots of strong support for this amongst polling. We have done polling at AEI with Echelon Insights. It's polled over 70%, regardless of income, political ideology, and race. We've just done a battleground poll with the Walton Family Foundation in three battleground states. Huge support, including amongst conservatives. And so this is a winning issue. It's an easy issue to fix, but it's more importantly a necessary issue in order to make sure that kids don't fall further behind and that we can make the best of what is a very difficult situation for kids going back to school this year.
Thanks, John. That's an excellent overview of the current situation and sort of the action that's happening in Congress now. We've got a lot of questions that are already coming in from folks on the call, and I want to kind of bucket some of these together. There's a lot of questions around this issue of internet access and broadband access that you addressed, and I'll read one of them, then I want to build on it a little bit based on some of the comments you made. We've got questions from Hillary Avalon in Oregon, Vic Bell in Detroit, Carmen Hillman in Ohio, and I'll read Vic's question from Detroit. Vic says, Detroit's one of the oldest cities in America. What federal funding is available to create the required infrastructure for citywide internet access so all students may engage in virtual classrooms? So this is getting to this, you know, broadband access question and also the equity piece. And I would kind of build build on that with your discussion around the size and the need. I mean, what do we need? How many billions of dollars do you think we need in order to be invested in this to get internet access everywhere in the country with the speed that's required to make an impact during this COVID timeline?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's actually, there's two questions within Vic's question. One is, there's the affordability of broadband and devices. And that's a little bit what the $4 billion is being proposed to address. The $4 billion is the students who don't have a connection, who don't have a device. How much does it take to get that roughly 9 million students a device and connections? And the good news is there seems to be people gravitating around the $4 billion would be enough to give them that device, to help them with a MiFi hotspot, or to help them with paying for something like Comcast Internet Essentials, something that is in their community and it addresses the affordability issue. There's a second question, though, that's underlying Nick's question, which is, what do we do about areas that don't have great reliable broadband or don't have broadband at all? This tends to be in rural areas, but it frankly is in a number of urban areas as well. And that's where you have to build out the infrastructure. You have to build the towers. You have to dig the ditches to put in the fiber. That is a separate issue that I think some of us have thought would get addressed as part of an infrastructure bill, as part of this next phase of the economic package. But it looks like they're going to punt on doing infrastructure to a later bill. And so, again, I've seen huge bipartisan support for providing funding to help build out this infrastructure in areas like Detroit, as well as in rural areas. But that is probably going to be in a future bill. What we need urgently is that affordability provision. That would be the $4 billion as part of this next package.
Gotcha. So the affordability piece is putting devices in families' hands and also connectivity to the existing infrastructure that's there.
That's correct.
The second piece is more of a longer term play of building out that infrastructure, which I'm not an expert on this, but I can't imagine that could even be done all that quickly. I mean, that seems to be months, if not years, to build out the adequate infrastructure. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, it takes time to get the permitting and the zoning and to dig the ditches, to put up the towers. And I think what you've seen with a lot of the Senate and House, frankly, infrastructure proposals to build out broadband infrastructure are incentives, not just to pay for it, but also to help accelerate some of the permitting and rights of way that you need to get it out into these spaces. It's also critically important that we make sure that Congress and the FCC are doing better broadband mapping, so we know like where broadband infrastructure is and where it's not, which communities are most underserved, and to use that as a way of prioritizing where to build out that infrastructure. But it does take months, in some cases years, unfortunately.
So once the infrastructure is either in place or people at least have the devices and connectivity, which is a massive hurdle as it is, but if we can solve that problem, another problem is the actual programming that's going to the kids in this remote learning environment. I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son, and we're blessed enough to have reliable internet, but it is a handful to help them all day long with their schooling and their homework while trying to hold down a day job. And so we have several questions that have come in from folks. There's Paul Sawyer in my hometown of Dallas. There is a question from Sonia Price in Alexandria, Virginia, and from Lola Scheifelbein in Washington State. And they're all fairly similar questions around the programmatic side of things. So Paul asks, why have schools been left without a national digital resources program for each grade and course? And Sonia asks a question around, how can parents best support students with homework or math concepts when parents have limited access to instructional material? So this is really around, what can we do better to close the homework gap with quality online programming and parental support?
Yes, these are great questions. I love these questions because they're absolutely right that just giving a kid a computer and internet connectivity is only really, frankly, the first step. It's not going to guarantee great quality instruction or high quality education content on the other end. We need to do that in partnership with schools, as well as like different ways of supporting parents too. So I think there's a couple different things. To Paul's question, some schools have actually had a digital resources program. They've tended to be schools that have always faced the threat of some sort of natural disaster. So like Miami-Dade Public County School District made a very easy adjustment into remote learning, in part because they've had to plan for years of a disruption to running a school based on hurricanes hitting them. We were hearing about students in the Midwest that often face blizzards having these things called blizzard bags that were already printed resources that the kids could take home with them because, again, a blizzard could shut down a school for a period of days and sometimes weeks. Schools are very uneven places in terms of their implementation of thinking about digital resources. The good news is that it's never been easier, frankly, to help sort of curate and use curated resources. Common Sense Media has one called Wide Open Schools, but there's other ones that are out there too with ISTE. And it's just places that parents and teachers can go to help find high quality resources that they can use as part of their programming. The good news, too, is that CARES Act provided about $13 billion for schools to purchase digital content, to purchase training and professional development for their teachers. And so hopefully with those dollars, it's going to help give teachers both the content as well as the support they need to do more interactive video conferencing with their kids as part of this next school year. Now, Sonia's question is really important too, because it's a little bit of a different, like how can she and how can parents find good resources? And again, the good news is that there's a lot of resources out there that parents can turn to. Places like Khan Academy, which offers, you know, essentially free math courses and free tutoring courses. We're seeing popping up around the country these things called parent pods, where parents and teachers are forming little volunteer groups that are helping provide childcare, but also providing instructional opportunities as well. There are some companies facilitating this too with teachers. There's a company called OutSchool that takes teachers and helps connect them into different types of activities with a small group of kids. I frankly think this is something that we kind of need across the country right now, that regardless of whether schools open or close, there's about 646,000 teachers who have the underlying health conditions that make it too risky for them to go back into a classroom. And so they're going to need to stay at home. And if they're staying at home, this could create the opportunity for us to build a national teacher corps to take those teachers, to help give them some support and some training and let them teach or provide mentoring or do other types of tutoring with students all around the country and to help support parents during this homeschooling process as well.
Well, I'll say two organizations you mentioned, I'll put the personal testimonial for the OutSchool has been tremendous for my kids during the summer. It really is awesome just how it links interesting content with teachers from all across the country. And my kids have signed up for a bunch of those, and they must be heavily subsidized because they're very affordable, which is wonderful. And Common Sense Media is definitely a source we go to when we're debating whether the kids can watch a certain movie or not all the time, because they have very, very good ratings for those that they provide. So I appreciate both those organizations. And on sort of that, I guess, second point about a force for good or bad in the internet and TV, there's actually an interesting question from Benjamin Bacon in Savannah, Georgia, I wanted to read you. He writes, when television was invented, it was probably touted as an asset to our educational objectives, but look at what became of that potential. The internet and modern media now have the same potential for improving the availability of education and closing the homework gap. Is anyone paying attention to the lessons that history can teach us and making efforts not to repeat the same mistake? So how do we think of this internet availability, and as we get devices and connectivity in more people's hands throughout the country, making sure it stays a force for good and not a potential force for bad?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, in many ways, the internet helps to democratize access to content. It's easy to get good content like you would find on Khan Academy, but it's also easy to get really bad content that is not good out there. And so I think, to Benjamin's point, many of us that have been working in education technology and digital learning for the last couple of decades really have drawn from the lessons of a lot of the, frankly, overpromising of the power of film and television that just underdelivered. And frankly, in the early days of the internet, we had a lot of that same overpromising and underdelivering, that just giving kids access to the internet didn't necessarily improve their education or their instruction. You know, that's not surprising. When you think about this, these are all tools, and the value comes not from the tool itself, but from how the tool is used. And so obviously what makes the internet and technology powerful today is how it's used by a skilled teacher by families and by kids themselves. And so the key here is making sure that there's content that's engaging and available for students. But more importantly, I think what we want to see more of in this next coming school year is not just students sitting in front of a screen watching videos, but having rich interactive dialogues with their teachers and with their other classmates. And that was something that, frankly, we did not see a lot of back in the spring. The Census Bureau has been doing these amazing household pulse surveys every week, almost during the COVID crisis. And one of the questions they asked parents is, out of the last 7 days, how many hours did your child spend in an interaction with their teachers, live interaction with their teachers? So it could be through calls, it could be through an interactive video conferencing like Zoom. And what we found is that on average, it was less than 4 hours. And that's pretty shocking, because I think what many of us thought with remote learning and online learning is that kids were doing a lot of Zoom sessions, and it just doesn't look to be the case based on some of this more recent survey data. The key, I think, is going to be, how do we do more Zoom-like video interactions between teachers and between kids? It doesn't have to be one teacher doing a Zoom with like 30 kids at a time. There's ways to break this up. There's ways to pull other teachers from around the country that, again, are stuck at home because it's too unsafe for them to go into the classroom. Ways to leverage the substitute pool of educators that are out there. There's ways to kind of pull them in and make them part of an engaging type of instructional program. But that's what's really going to set remote learning and online learning apart from past experiments of just pushing out video and using education film in the past.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the role of companies, corporations in solving this problem. You know, you've articulated that we need a large investment from the federal government to closing this gap. Where have you seen companies that are doing good partnerships at the local level, public-private partnerships, investments at the local level to help solve this gap? Is there an example or examples you can share with us?
Sure. I think there's two things. I mean, companies that can and make donations or help support their schools with purchasing these devices of connectivity. We're seeing that in Detroit, San Francisco, and many parts of Governor Newsom in California has launched a digital divide fund that he's collecting donations from big companies as well as small companies to help close that gap. The same thing in New Jersey, we're seeing with the governor there. So there's ways of, whether big at the state level or small within your local school districts, going in and helping closing the divide could be a big step. The second, which is something that every business can do, is we have to approach the reopening of schools with a bit of humility and just giving grace to parents and to schools that are trying to make the best of a very challenging situation. And the more flexible that businesses can be with their employees who are at home trying to juggle work along with just trying to make ends meet, along with just trying to help make sure their kids are learning, they're going to need a lot of extra support given the disruption, frankly, to workers' schedules that's going to come as a result of the disruption to school schedules. And then lastly, you know, again, don't underestimate the business voices with federal advocacy right now. The key group that is going to be instrumental in making sure that we're able to close the homework gap as part of this next economic package is going to be Senate Republicans. And so Senate Republicans are really concerned and listening very closely to business voices and what do businesses need. So just using your voice is going to have a huge influence in helping us as part of this next package here.
Excellent. And I want to ask you a couple of questions that we've received around this equity issue. You mentioned Raj Chetty's study, you know, just showing the discrepancies and the major gaps in online platforms usage. And I think there are a lot of examples of that pre-COVID and certainly how that's amplified during COVID. But we'd love for you to talk a little more about equity. There's two questions. Sonia Walls in Columbia, Maryland asks, will closing the homework gap work for single and working parents on a fixed income? And Jonette Woods asks an equity-based question about how can we ensure that our learners with disabilities will receive the additional assistance they need, for example, kids that have reading difficulties. Could you talk a little bit more to both of those questions?
Yeah, so I mean, it's great questions. With single parents and with working parents that are on fixed income, super important that, again, as part of this next economic package, we see other types of support that are going to give those individuals the space to be able to help their kids with learning over this next fall. So that includes everything from the direct cash benefit that right now I think is getting bandied about at $1,200 plus $500 per dependent. I would actually advocate that $500 should be higher. I think it should be at least $1,000, if not $1,500, in part because families, especially fixed income families, have a lot more educational costs than they did when kids were in school. And that could be childcare costs, it could be food costs, it could also just be buying the books and some of the other resources. And so that's going to be critical. Extending the expanded unemployment, super critical there as well. Then making sure that there's childcare options available is going to be super important for families as well. It's something that Congress just has not paid enough attention to, but if you want to reopen schools, if you want to reopen businesses, they're going to need childcare in order to, for workers to be able to go back to work. And so there's ways to do that safely. We have new guidance from the CDC that just came out a week ago, but we're going to need some additional funds to help get those childcare facilities started again. Special needs students are probably the most vulnerable out of all the vulnerable students because, again, for some students, they're going to be able to do online learning and it could be a good substitute. Many won't be able to. And I think it's going to be really critically important for schools to have a special needs plan for their students as schools are opening up in whatever type of context. One of the best models that I've seen for this came out of Israel. And in Israel, what they did in the spring is that they closed their schools to help slow the spread. The students shifted to online learning. But what they did is they kept the schools open for the special needs students. And because there were so few students in the building, they could spread out the special needs students and give them more of the one-on-one type of attention and therapies and special services that they need to help those students succeed. That feels like a great model that schools can embrace here in terms of keeping some students home and bringing in some of your most vulnerable students back into the classroom, but spacing them out with all the other types of protections and precautions that the CDC is recommending to protect both the students as well as the teachers.
Gotcha. Thank you, John. Jonathan Dworkin in D.C. is asking about what are steps that you'd recommend for policymakers outside of Washington, D.C. at the state and local level to address this issue. And you've talked, I think, a little bit about at the sort of independent school district level, but I wonder what kind of packages do you think need to be put forward at the state level and maybe at the city or county level across the country to help close the homework gap?
Really important. Governors have a huge role here. And in fact, you know, governors are increasingly getting parts of federal funding with a lot of flexibility that they can allocate to whatever types of priorities that they feel are most urgently needed for their states. And so what we're seeing is a number of governors that have taken CARES Act dollars and they're putting it towards devices and connectivity for kids, where they're putting it towards buying and licensing a high quality online curriculum and online resources for their teachers and their students and their parents to use. So really important to weigh in with governors and with the state departments of education as they're working on these reopening plans, as they're also allocating these types of resources and making sure it's getting targeted towards the right things. And then longer term, this goes back to the first question that you asked about building out infrastructure, that it's really going to take governors prioritizing this and mayors as well, working on with rights of way, working on proposals that sort of balance business needs with community needs, and making sure that we can clear out some of the regulatory underbrush so that infrastructure can get built out super quickly and super fast on many of these different things. And then lastly, especially with business voices, at the end of the day, opening schools, keeping schools closed, going to remote only, or doing hybrid learning are going to be very local decisions. And they're decisions that can't be made solely and unilaterally by a school because they have implications for everyone in that community. So it's really important that business leaders are engaging their superintendents, engaging their principals, and making sure that there's communication and collaboration sort of agreements in place so that if a school is thinking about closing or they're thinking about opening, that again, business leaders are brought into that process early as opposed to finding out through a tweet or through an announcement and then being left scrambled on how to accommodate their employees that are parents. And so building those relationships, giving support to the superintendents who are making really difficult and challenging decisions and with no sort of win situations right now are going to be super critical too.
Well, I think we have time for maybe just one more question, and I think this is a good one to end on, from Douglas Bender with MJC and Associates in Houston, Texas. And Douglas asks, will there be a new normal going forward, and what will that look like for parents and students? So imagine a world where we're post-COVID and finally past this pandemic, and we've made these investments, and there is more, hopefully, connectivity and devices out there. What does a new normal look like? Do we go back to what we were doing before? Is there some hybrid? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends who you talk to. Like, I think I've met tons of parents who are like, please, let's go back to normal.
Right.
Out of the house, right? So, like, I think what we're going to see is a resumption of some element of normal. Like, we're going to get kids back in the classroom. Kids want to be back in the classroom. Parents want their kids back in the classroom. We're going to still have classrooms. That's super, super critical. But I do think, like, we're going to see these lingering benefits that have come from schools radically shifting so many of their thinking and services over onto the cloud, into online services. We may never need a snow day ever again in the United States because we've had so much different experiments and experience, frankly, now going to remote learning. I think we're seeing schools that are experimenting with other types of online services that aren't just purely learning and instruction. So for instance, there's a company called Hazel Health that does telemedicine specifically for students and teachers in schools. And all of a sudden, I think you're going to see telemedicine explode as a service that's being able to be offered to complement already stressed and understaffed school nurses to give them additional capacity to help with caring for kids and their social emotional needs as well as their health and well-being. I think we're going to see a lot more students that have always wondered a bit about online learning and if they could continue that on themselves. It hasn't worked for every kid, but it has worked for some students. And so some could end up choosing this as the preferred mode of learning going forward. I don't think that's going to be a huge group of students. But again, even if it's a small percentage of students, you're still talking hundreds of thousands in the United States. But more importantly, I hope what this is going to create is, like, as you're seeing in businesses, COVID is creating this moment where you have to go back and question every fundamental assumption of your organization and start with the fundamentals and build up from there. And so my hope is that what comes out of COVID is a school model that works better for kids, especially the underserved students and the equity challenges that we were facing with so many kids. And that we have a system that's better serving them on the other side of this in a way that is preserving the best of what we have to offer in the classroom with the best of what we have with digital technologies and online learning as well.
No more snow days. I have not heard that one before, but I guess it makes sense. There will be kids protesting in the streets when we take snow days away, I think. we don't get too many snow days in Dallas, but we do have State Fair Day every year, and we're not giving that one up. So although there's no State Fair this year, but when that resumes, we're not giving up State Fair Day. So. Well, thank you so much, John. Is there any final thought you want to leave with folks before we sign off and wrap up?
No, just that I appreciate all the good work that Business Forward is doing, and thanks for taking time to ask these really important questions and for giving me space to be able to talk with you today.
For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Ed Meyer, and Jim Doyle. Produced and engineered by Alexia Lipman and Alex Passanen. Special thanks to our Director of Programming, Jana Platt. Thank you for listening. See you next time.